We are continuing with our invited testimony with Gwen Dayton and Paul Frisch regarding HIPAA and how the federal privacy regulations will impact health care delivery in Oregon after the magic date of April 14, 2003. Enter and sign in, please.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm Vice President General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I'm also a member of the advisory committee, as is Paul Frisch, that looked at how Oregon law needs to change in light of HIPAA. And Paul and I also participated in the health law section medical records privacy committee that looked at preemption over the course of last summer and the fall. So we are HIPAA.
We are HIPAA?
We are HIPAA. And you are HIPAA heroes. Because by the time we're done today, you'll be as thoroughly confused as the rest.
Cool. All right, that's our goal.
I brought for you, Gwen has brought some things for you. I brought for you our privacy handbook. Inside on the left-hand side are your protected health information stickers, don't drop the ball, a CD-ROM that contains all of our forms, policies, and procedures, which are also in writing in the book. And what we want you to focus on is... you'll have an opportunity, as I talk about some of these things today, to take a look in the form section at some of the heavy-duty paperwork that HIPAA gives rise to. These are some documents that were prepared by our association. Hospital Association has some forms that it's done. The idea, however, has been that we have been collaborative in trying to work together to make sure we don't have the battle of the forms to the extent we can. But I'll talk about some of those things as we go along. I have my handouts for you, which are a day in the life of Dr. Mum. And I also have a matrix, which I brought to you, which is really going to be the best piece of information you can have from me. But for me, this is going to show you in graphic detail what constitutes an activity involving THI, whether or not it's for treatment, payment, or healthcare operations. If not, is an authorization required? Is a business associate agreement required? And the concept of minimum necessary. All terms we kind of talked about a little bit yesterday. But you get a real full appreciation. It is a seven-page document. We have tried to imagine every circumstance in which protected health information might be used or disclosed. I think you get a pretty good overview. And Glenn and I will talk to you about that. Right now, what I want to do is quickly take you on a brief tour in the day in the life of Dr. Mum.
Is Dr. Mum the one that treated Mr. Smith? Or?
It is. Okay. He is, in fact, the one that treated Mr. Smith.
Okay.
Now, what I want to do for you today is show you briefly where we are in current law in Oregon and where we are under HIPAA. And to do that, I'm just going to bring these all up consistent with your... and just let's take a quick look. We talked yesterday briefly about sign-in sheets. Clearly, under both current Oregon law and HIPAA, that would not be an issue. In the second one, Mr. Kondriak, the patient, has a history and intake forms, and a staff member gives them those forms and tells Mr. Kondriak the office is fresh out of copies of its notice of privacy practices, but you have some on the next visit. What this points out is that... under Oregon law, no such notice of privacy practices is currently required. Under HIPAA, if you're a direct treatment provider, and in this case, Dr. Mum is directly treating Mr. Kondriak, there is going to be a need for that notice of privacy practices to be distributed. And had Mr. Kondriak contacted Dr. Mum via a website, it would have been the responsibility of Dr. Mum to make that notice of privacy practices available on the website at that time. Now, under the forms that you have here, we have Form E under Forms, page 1. You will see what a Notice of Privacy Practices that attempts to comply with the privacy rule consists of. And it is 5 pages of relatively small type. I don't know how big yours is.
Ours is that, which you also have. This is the hospital one, which you should have in front of you. It's somewhat longer. And we'll talk about this a little bit later, but a lot of the reason that it's somewhat longer is because it is a joint notice of privacy practices between the physicians that practice in the hospital and the hospital itself. And we'll talk later about those relationships under HIPAA.
That's because if you imagine the requirement of the notice of privacy practices, picture all the physicians wandering through the hospital with one of those newspaper delivery bags slung over their shoulder with stacks of notices of privacy practices, which under the original rule when first published would have required, before they could have interacted with the patient, they would have to give them their own notice of privacy practice. That's been withdrawn. Now a joint arrangement is there.
Yes. Mr. Chair. If I could make a suggestion, I assume that these are set up so that your partners can copy them and provide them to for folks. You might bump up the type size slightly so that it fills a total of 6 pages that would be 3 back-to-back, because you're still going to need that back-to-back. And a lot of our seniors, this is, looks like about 12-point to me, and that's a little small for a number of them.
The beauty of this is that it's there and available, because each office may want to and probably should adapt, and then they can up it to the size
needed.
That they want.
Great. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, what do you mean by adapt? I mean, they pretty much have to follow this form, don't they?
Users write the physician's name in. I mean,
okay, that sort of thing.
You may have privacy practices that are stricter, okay, that more protected. You may have some additional things that you want to add in. HIPAA doesn't envision that this is a must-do in this form. This is merely the baseline for what we interpret as the baseline.
Okay.
Although,
but
that having been said, HIPAA is very expressed on what needs to be in it. There's a long
okay.
list of
okay.
requirements.
Okay, so this is, okay.
This is a long list.
But there's nothing the patient signs to acknowledge receipt or having read this, or is there? Not on this form, though.
The HIPAA regulations require that providers make a good faith effort to obtain acknowledgement that the patient received the notice of privacy practices. Hospitals typically are either having that as a tear-off a form at the bottom of the notice, or they're giving them a separate acknowledgement form. There is a model or acknowledgement form on the OAHHS website that asks for just for a date and a signature at the bottom, because the patient will take this with them, but the hospital or the physician will keep the acknowledgement in their own record.
Form A for us is the acknowledgement.
Okay, okay.
The fact that a patient does not or refuses to sign does not appreciate the effectiveness of what we've done. An effort, a good faith effort to make it occur is all sufficient. I just want to touch on the bottom one. Nurse privy checks Kondriak's vitals, records them in the chart, and explains her observations regarding Mr. Kondriak to Dr. Mum. Believe it or not, on the surface, this all looks okay. But under the surface, there is one point to be made, and that is that some uses, particularly psychotherapy notes, may not be disclosable without patient authorization, even in the practice setting, between two people working in the practice. The idea of minimum necessary at work here. So we always want to think in terms of the concept of what's the use for, who should be having that access to that information, and how should that information be conveyed. On the next page, Paul. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Before you get off the signature page, Paul, I know with treatment there's always the issue of, I guess there's always been the issue of the person's capacity if there's incompetency involved. Does HIPAA kind of raise the bar at all in that, and how is that handled differently?
I think Paul and I would answer that similarly. HIPAA provides for personal representatives in the same way that current state law does and most state laws do. That you can have a substitute signature and perhaps a guardian if somebody is incapacitated. So there's the opportunity for somebody else to sign in that circumstance. Yeah.
If it doesn't interfere with normal operation of state law with respect to substitute consent.
Okay.
Dr. Mum's office calls Kondriak's health plan to determine eligibility. Currently, we don't think in terms of needing consent to do that. Under HIPAA, it's okay because it's treatment, payment, or health care operations in this case is going to be payment. You're not going to get paid unless you determine eligibility. So that's okay. Whoops. Completing the billing sheet with diagnosis and procedure codes and forwarding them to an outside billing service. Here, it's important to note that we're going to an outside billing service, so that outside billing service is going to be receiving protected health information from Mum. Therefore, there must be in place a business associate agreement. This is the way that the drafters of this rule got around their authority to extend the privacy rule to entities that they don't really have authority over. Those are the organizations like accountants, billing service, transcriptionists, and others who don't qualify as covered entities. But because they do business with these covered entities, share information, that is protected health information, the rule extends it by requiring the covered entity to execute a business associate agreement with the outside entity, making sure that they will comply with the requirements as such. So that's what we mean when we talk about a business associate agreement. And if you look over on the fourth column down of your TPO matrix, you'll begin to get a sense, this is our view, disclaimer, it's in flux. We're not sure, but this is the best we know at this point. These are the various business associates that we think exist under HIPAA today. You might. Okay. Mum's office called Pondriac's fire physicians Feelgood and Rorschach and requests all 45 years of records on file at each office. Typical Oregon practice today is that that would have to be authorized.
By who?
By the patient, by Pondriac.
Okay.
Under 192.525, in all likelihood, the existing statute that's going to be impacted by the proposal that the subcommittee has made. But under HIPAA, that would not be required. However, we do have that nasty issue of the psychotherapy notes. And we also have the issue that Feelgood and Rorschach, Feelgood and Rorschach are going to provide information, but Mum's office is under a duty to request only the minimum necessary. So what the mess up here, the complication in how things are going to occur, is that each office has certain responsibilities that are not present in Oregon law. For Rorschach and Feelgood, providing information will depend on whether or not their psychotherapy notes, and also Mum's office has got to remember they can only ask for what the minimum necessary is. Under our TPO matrix, you'll notice that the last column tries to delineate for you what kinds of records routinely would be requested, for instance, involving athletic trainers and sports programs. Probably more helpful would be a cancer registry or a collection agency. Notice that the cleaning service that's listed here on this list, we don't consider them a business associate. And the reason we don't is because they do not routinely, as a part of their activity, encounter protected health information. It's an incidental issue. Whereas a collection agency does routinely encounter. So that's what we're trying to address here. Mum's office orders a blood draw in their own lab, and Privy explains to the lab tech the details and suspected diagnosis of chondria. What's at issue here? Well, the but part on the end is, what is Nurse Privy doing explaining to the lab tech information that may not be within the scope of the activity that is legitimate for the lab tech? So again, this minimum necessary requirement. I'm going to quickly move through the next ones. On the way to the lab, Pondriac walks down the hallway and notices many things, which is calling your HIPAA violations. From your list, you can see that the wall of medical records we talked about, the unlocked files we talked about, the schedule of patients posted outside the lab, probably okay. However, they probably shouldn't contain the information we talked about yesterday. X-rays illuminate of the foot on the light board, in and of itself may not be a problem, but if there was something special that indicated a matter of concern, maybe that might be more of a problem. Overhearing another physician instructing a patient on the use of meds is not a problem. And seeing a picture of a patient's family on the office bulletin board, presumably those are going to be authorized. After the first visit, which of the following disclosures are permissible? Feelgood sends all of Pondriac's records, including notes from a separate file kept by Feelgood, to Mum's office. What do you think about that one? Is that okay? Well, under HIPAA, it raises some issues. First of all, It raises issues about what Glenn referred to yesterday as a designated record set. The designated record set is a very broadly worded term, and therefore it is possible that some things kept in files away from the traditional medical record will have significance and might in fact have to be disclosed. And how that is done and is expensive. I mean, Glenn's hospitals have an enormous problem. My physicians, who have multiple offices in multiple locations, potentially have tremendous problems identifying and correlating and making available their materials. In the PCP world, you're probably not going to have too many things that are going to be specially authorized, but again, the psychotherapy notes issue comes up.
Question?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mona Sanderson.
At least in county health, we have, or we did a few years back when I was working in the clinic, a separate place for the results of AIDS, AIDS diagnosis and HIV, and they're in a separate file. Is this what you're referring to then? Because usually they had a code of some kind on the file, and then that would say that there was something located in a different place. I mean, what's the issue here?
The issue, you want to talk in terms of the hospital's issue with respect to the broadness of the data set?
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Monis Anderson. The definition of designated record set in HIPAA is very, very broad. It includes not just what you would typically consider the medical record, but any other notes made about payment, for example, or source materials like x-rays.
Oh.
And they can be found not just in the file, the patient's file, but perhaps in other locations throughout the hospital. So our hospitals are going through the exercise of identifying what units or departments in the hospital actually might hold a portion of this designated record set, which is broader than just the kind of the legal medical record that you might give out. So that's the difference.
Can you guys talk closer to the mic?
Oh, you bet.
Thank you. Should I repeat that, or was that?
No, I heard it.
The definition is very, very broad of designated record set. And in a hospital setting, pieces. Really?
That's no, it's on.
It's on?
You need to get a little closer.
Okay. How's this? Thank you. The definition is so broad that pieces of the designated record set may be held in various parts of the hospital. And so it's a challenge for hospitals to ensure that if somebody asks for access to their designated record set, which they have every right to do, that the hospital is able to gather all those pieces together for them.
Okay. I forgot about x-rays. But why would they need accounting, billing?
That's payment. Part of the definition of the designated record set is information that's used to make healthcare decisions and decisions about payment.
Yeah. Not very practical.
No.
Okay. The third item on there is forwarding copies of the chart notes from the visit and lab results to the health plan for quality assurance activity. This is one where, under current Oregon law, it's probably okay. HIPAA makes it very clear that this kind of information is going to flow. I'm not sure that the public really fully understands how much identifiable information is going to be flowing back into the health plan. But the health plan is, in fact, a covered entity, is protected. They're supposed to protect the privacy of the patient's information. But for me, it's always made me a little uncomfortable that this is explicitly there. Forwarding the same chart notes and lab results to Profit Pharmaceuticals for inclusion in Profit's drug study. Not okay under Oregon law currently, not going to be okay under HIPAA unless properly authorized, but I can tell you that there are so many nuances related to this that an answer like this is not a complete and fair answer. There are situations under which this could, in fact, end up in Profit's hands and not necessarily be required.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to your previous point on the chart notes, to the health plan, are those so information that is essentially unrelated to which drugs are we paying for, which tests are we running? This is more detailed information. Why is that information being sent to the health plan? What is the purpose of that?
Okay. Health plans have as a mission, from their perspective, have as a mission to ensure the quality of care that's being rendered by the clinicians pays for, the services it pays for. And so, and a number of them like to do studies, participate in studies to determine the effectiveness of treatment, to determine the frequency or the denominator of treatment, and to determine if the treatment is a quality treatment. That information they claim a right to as a part of what they call their quality assurance activities to make sure everything is functioning properly. That's all I can say about
okay.
it.
To continue on,
follow up.
When you expressed your sense of some discomfort with this, and yet it doesn't show this is a change to current practice.
Right.
What is? Could you expand a little bit on your thinking on that point of discomfort? Because I'm sure you're not alone in this.
No.
Many of us would probably share that.
Okay. I believe that the way it works under Oregon law, when the patient signs up for insurance, they sign a rather broad authorization form. Most of the health plans have reached a point in their evolution that they include in that broad authorization to acquire insurance permission now and in the future to share, to receive information from clinicians related to quality assurance matters that they conduct. Health plans then contract with the physicians, and in those contracts, it's very clear that provided there's proper authorization, that information can flow back by contract. They agree to do that. So there's a statute that says that we can rely on the fact that the health plan has received authorization when supplying that information. So that's kind of the relationship I understand that gives rise to all this, my discomfort aside. Do you have a comment?
No, I don't. You said.
I think that's accurate.
Right.
Okay, but my question was about your discomfort.
Why am I discomfort?
Yes.
Well, I don't know that I thought I should have a choice in whether or not I should participate in a quality insurance activity. That's how I view it. I may just be the kind of person that isn't sure that I want my material floating around like that. So I don't want to give a blanket authorization. I'm somewhat discomforted by the fact that HIPAA makes it a part of the process so that they don't have to come to me specifically and ask me that. Nor do I think they have to under the turnover law.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Greenlick.
Could I follow on this? I mean, my understanding of it, we're talking about health plans generally, not the Oregon Health Plan in this case, is that the authorization to use it for quality assurance is limited, in fact, to that use only. So the fact that Health Plan A can use Chondriac's data in order to look at quality control of their providers doesn't mean they can then, having done that, now use the data for other fiscal purposes of the health plan.
That's correct. Whether they do or not, that is correct statement.
And if it's really limited to that, I mean, I do wonder about your discomfort.
I want a choice in the matter, and I think other people want a choice in the matter. I want to be able to say, you know what, I appreciate that you want to do that, but that's not something that I want to give you the right to use. That's just my personal view. It's the way I look at the world. I'd like a choice in all the things I do.
Can I follow up on
follow
that?
Follow up.
And this with both of you. I went into a hospital for a procedure, and they handed me this form that had all these disclosures in it. And I scratched out all the things that they had on the form and wrote in only for my health, my own personal health care needs, or for quality assurance or something like that. And the admitting clerk didn't even look at me and just took the form that I had signed and put it in a file. Is that somehow going to be affected by this? I mean, wouldn't you expect that person to...
I mean,
I made my own declaration. You're saying you don't want it in quality. I scratched it out. And what standing does that have when I scratch it out and initial it?
If you've crossed it out, and this is Gwen Dayton, if you crossed it out and initialed it, then you have refused to consent to those disclosures. And HIPAA does allow a patient to request restrictions on the release of their information. And I think crossing something like that out on an authorization form would have that effect.
Will it actually do anything, though? I mean, do I have a right to assume somebody will actually look at that and say, oh, Greenlink's done this cockamamie thing, so we need to make sure we don't give out Greenlink's data now?
In a perfect world, absolutely.
No, I'm talking about the real world.
Well, the real world I can't speak to.
Excuse me, Steve.
That's all right. No, but I think that the intention of HIPAA is that now you can go back and look at your records and find out if indeed they've shared those records to, you know, outside the realm of your your authorization, in theory.
If they've tracked it.
Kind of. HIPAA allows a patient or individual, better said, to request an accounting of disclosures of their record. There are, however, significant exceptions to that right. A hospital, using them as the provider example, does not have to account for disclosures made for purposes of treatment, payment, or healthcare operations, which includes this quality assurance that we've been discussing. Mm-hmm. So there would not be an obligation to account for those disclosures. There are obligations to account for other disclosures. Typically, they are disclosures the hospital is required to make by law. Other, most other disclosures are subject to an exception.
If I may, it's a misconception generally for the public that these logging of these disclosures is going to be comprehensive and is going to tell you where your record has been. Frankly, it's the smallest amount.
No, it's not. Nobody in the public believes.
I'm gonna stop here because I want Gwen to have an opportunity and for you to ask questions. This is fun, but it can go on, and it's not going to accomplish as much as if we just have some interchange.
Okay.
Well, I'll let you know what I brought with me today for you to review, and I think it is Paul and my intentions now to let you ask whatever questions you might have. I brought with me, of course, the joint notice of privacy practices that we've discussed briefly, and I will only say a few more words about that. The hospital notice of privacy practice is intended to join with it not just the hospital, but physicians that are on staff. Privileged physicians that can come to the hospital and see patients there. The reason they do this is because of the HIPAA concept of an organized healthcare arrangement, that if entities, providers that are clinically integrated or hold themselves out as providing services in a joint manner to patients, HIPAA provides that those people can share a notice of privacy practices. That's important because, as Paul said, the last thing physicians want to do is come to the hospital with a big bag of privacy notices and the poor sick person in their bed thrust this in front of them and go over the privacy practices. As a practical matter, though, this only deals with privacy in the hospital. Once the physician goes back to their office, they have to give the patient another one, because this only deals with what the physician will do with the person's records while they're treating the person in the hospital. So these notices are the subject of a lot of attention these days because it's the first thing the patient gets, because it explains your privacy practices. If you don't act in accordance with this notice, that's the first sign of trouble. So the notice must adequately describe what you are going to be doing, and there is lots of room to not get this right. I've done a fair amount of research on these and over the Internet predominantly, and there are a number of notices out there that don't seem to have some of the required elements. So this is a focal point as we all try to get HIPAA right. The other document that I brought goes a completely different direction. We can discuss it now or later as you choose. I brought with me a kind of a white paper on HIPAA preemption. HIPAA preemption is currently one of the priorities of discussion. Preemption relates to how state law survives after a federal law is implemented or adopted. And state law essentially is preempted, meaning made ineffective, if it is contrary to HIPAA, or essentially if it's contrary to HIPAA and providers and others cannot comply with both state and federal law. If state law is actually more protective of patient privacy, more protective of patient rights, even if it's contrary, it survives. So HIPAA is the floor. Oregon can establish a higher ceiling if it chooses to. What this document does, and I'm not going to go through all of it for reasons that are, I think, evident by its thickness, talks about the legislation that's out there right now to change Oregon law in light of HIPAA. And it also, and the reason why we went down that road, why we felt these pieces of legislation were necessary. It also talks about where Oregon law will stay the same, significant Oregon law. I'm sure that there are some that we did not touch on. It was my intention to go to the areas of law of most concern to people. And I think the most significant areas where Oregon law will stay the same are in the area of specially protected records. HIV/AIDS records will remain specially protected, as will mental health, as will genetic information, as will drug and alcohol records. Under HIPAA, those records are given no special protection at all. But there really was never any question in Oregon that we would retreat from that special protection. It was never proposed. It was never considered. So those remain, and it is absolutely clear that they remain good law. So, the only other area that I'll touch on briefly, because it was a subject of some controversy, is that under a prior iteration of the HIPAA rules, parents were in large part prevented from getting the records of their children if their children were old enough to consent to health care. And that was a big problem. It was also a problem for the health plans because they couldn't send out payment information because that was releasing information to the parents because they're typically the policyholder. The August version of the rules retreated from that. It was their expressed intention to allow parents access to the minors' records as that access would be provided under state law. So if state law would give you access, then HIPAA will not deny you access. And that is a, I believe, a positive development. Otherwise, we would have had significant Oregon law preempted and significant restriction on access, legitimate access, in my opinion, to records. So that is also a discussion of that issue is also contained in this document. What's also in here, and I'll just raise this to let you know some of the difficulties with HIPAA. There are some statutes that the Advisory Committee on Privacy of Medical Records, I'm not going to get that quite right, it's actually, we call it the Senate Bill 104 Committee, because nobody can remember the entire name for the Advisory Committee, identified several statutes that really aren't preempted, but their implementation is going to be difficult after HIPAA, and we struggled with how to deal with them, frankly. There are several statutes that talk about investigations for, one is commitment of mentally retarded people, the other is court visitors looking at establishing some sort of a guardianship or other protective proceeding. And both those statutes are similar in that they allow an investigator or a court visitor to go talk to a physician about the subject of either the commitment or the protective proceeding. And that's fine. HIPAA doesn't preempt that. But the problem is that the physician doesn't have any ability to give information to the investigator because the release is not for treatment, payment, and health care operations. So therefore, and it's not required by law that the physician release this, HIPAA allows state law to remain if it requires disclosure. But these statutes don't require disclosure. So after HIPAA, it will require an authorization or some kind of legal process in order for the physician to release information. And there was the original version of the legislation to tackle this made the disclosure mandatory. Let's just put it under required by law. But there are advocates for the disabled and others that make the point that you're authorizing too much information or inappropriate information to be released, and that taking that tact is inappropriate. And the Senate Bill 104 Committee, frankly, was concerned about establishing new policy. We weren't there to make new policy. We were there to make Oregon law consistent with HIPAA. And so because of those concerns, we retreated somewhat and now are recommending that the statutes be amended merely to clarify the need for some level of patient permission or legal process. And that will be difficult. It will make the system potentially more cumbersome and maybe not inappropriately so. I'm not expressing an opinion one way or the other. But those are the issues that we're dealing with. Or there's another statute that allows a hospital, if somebody comes in after a motor vehicle accident when there's reasonable cause to believe they were the driver, and it is apparent that they are or were under the influence of intoxicants. Statute right now allows but does not require the hospital to notify law enforcement. After HIPAA, that will not be allowed without patient authorization or legal process, which would be a subpoena or a court order in effect. And the same, we went through the same process. At first, we made that mandatory, which, frankly, some hospitals supported as consistent with their mission to protect the public. They want to be able to do these reports. Others were concerned that in the chaos of maybe an emergency department situation where you've got somebody that came in after a motor vehicle accident, nobody picks up the phone and calls. you know, then all of a sudden you're setting up a violation of the law. The long and short of that one is we is the Senate Bill 104 committee backed up and decided, again, we don't want to make public policy. We want to stick with what we need to do to make Oregon law consistent with HIPAA, and now have a recommendation that the statute be amended to clarify the need for patient permission or legal process. So there will be those issues that HIPAA implicates, even though it is simply because of its the kind of patient permission it requires in certain circumstances. So, and we'll all adjust.
Representative Cruz, looks like you have a question.
Well, I was just wondering on, you know, how just acknowledging that information needs to exchange makes it qualify or meets HIPAA guidelines. If you don't make it mandatory, how is that information exchange possible?
If the exchange is of protected health information and it is
right.
It is a provider that is disclosing it, that provider will need to comply with HIPAA, and that means getting an authorization.
Well, I understand that, and like with the drunk driver thing, you know, if making it mandatory would allow for the hospital to, that would comply with HIPAA. But if you don't make it mandatory, are you still requiring the patient to okay the exchange of information? Because, you know, if I was in an accident and I was drunk and the hospital had that information and they asked if it'd be okay if they released that to the police, I'd probably say no.
That's right. And that's why in that circumstance I seriously doubt that the hospital will go and try to obtain an authorization from the patient. I think the more likely course is they will tell law enforcement if they inquire that they need to get a subpoena or a court order.
Question?
Just a second. But isn't that, that's dropping hints. That's kind of skirting the issue, isn't it? I mean, it's almost saying, okay, but they couldn't go to law enforcement and say, here's something we think you ought to look at. But they, if law enforcement came to them, they could say, well, we can't give you any information, but we think you ought to inquire.
No,
you know, I see just not, tons of shaky ground here.
Well, there is. They could not affirmatively pick up the phone and call the police and say, we've got somebody here that you should be concerned with, because that would be releasing protected health information.
Right.
That's not allowed. If law enforcement comes to their door and says, do you have somebody that came in after a motor vehicle accident? I don't know. Do you think they could really? I don't. No, they couldn't. I don't think they could. I'm trying to think. There's lists of exceptions for things that you can release under HIPAA. You can release certain information to identify or locate a suspect.
Right.
And they are very limited. They are. There's a. Paul's pulling it out.
Yeah. Let me get
one. I think blood type, I think, is one, and nature of injuries, I think, might be another. Things like that. But I don't think that if law enforcement came in and said, there's a car crash. We think the driver was drunk. You came in by ambulance. Do you have that person here, and can we talk to him? I don't think in that circumstance they could.
You couldn't even tell them that you had the person then.
No, because that would be releasing the person's name and their location in your hospital.
It seems that we're working at cross purposes here to a large degree.
Mm-hmm.
I can see why you are. Of course, if it was mandatory that under a set of circumstances the information is disclosed, then you're all right with HIPAA and it's business as usual, right?
If it was mandatory, the hospital would be required to make the call in that particular circumstance.
Right.
The statute's very specific about the circumstances. They would be required to make the call.
But we will no longer have that. Is that what you're saying?
Depends on what the legislature decides to do.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you. I have a question regarding immunizations. We are always updating immunizations on our children in schools, and so they'll come into the clinic, they don't have their immunization record, so usually as a nurse I would just get on the phone and call the provider. Now, you say, is provider to provide? In that instance, can I just call the provider and say, I need the immunization history for this? And usually it's the state of Washington or California or another clinic in the state. Otherwise, that'll be a barrier to immunizations for our children.
They're entitled to immunization information by law. So,
I think so.
My advice would be that they cooperate.
Yeah.
Because I think it's required by law.
That would be my advice, too.
Say that again.
Yes.
I believe that it's required by law.
It is.
To provide this information. Therefore, it falls into the exception. Therefore, it's
the exception.
Provided.
Okay.
That's a good exception.
Yes.
If I may, I just wanted to let you know, two questions came up. Gwen's answered the one about special permissions. And in your forms, you can see back here, I think it's actually in the resources section, pages 5 in the resources section through 9. These are examples, or 11. These are examples of all of the special authorization forms that currently exist under Oregon law and will not be affected by, these aren't them. These are what we came up with, but they represent the need. And these will not be changed by HIPAA. The other thing I wanted to do, a question came up about compliance and what impact is compliance going to have on providing care. And what I wanted to do is just kind of run through the OMA's 11-step program for compliance, because I think it, I won't go in any detail, but just to give you a sense of the enormity of the task for an office as small as a single office or an office as large as the Portland Clinic with several hundred folks. It's on page 1 of the resources, and just take a look. You know, you've got to determine the personnel considerations. Got to create a privacy officer position. You have to train somebody to be a privacy officer, and you have to create a job description for the contact person that's going to be dealing with the public here. That may be the same person in most offices. You have to assess your current information practices. That's probably a good thing, but the level of detail, as you can see here on page 1, is pretty significant, and you're going to have to take a pretty darn good look at how you do your information sharing. The policies and procedures, just to flip back for you, there's a whole section here under procedures, pages 1 through 29 or 30. Those represent our view of model procedures. So whether you're a big office or a small office, you're going to have to adopt some forms relating to acknowledgments and consents and disclosures, minimum necessary and the like. The rest of these listed down here give you a pretty good idea of what you have to do, including under 6, you have to develop and implement a training program. So that's going to have some cost and some time involved with it. The security safeguards are going to have to include not only administrative, but also computer, technical, as well as the doors and other areas, and then provide training for them. Under 8 and 9, you've got to have your policies and procedures relating to sanctions in case one of your employees screw up, and you're going to have to have a plan for mitigating violations. You have to make sure that you don't go after people who blow the whistle on you, and you have to make sure that you have proper documentation. This is really where the heart of the difficulty in HIPAA comes, because this is an awful lot of paperwork. It's an awful lot of activity surrounding something that, if you make a mistake, even a good faith mistake, it could result in some time-consuming explanations and involvements. It's the law. We have to follow it, and we certainly encourage everyone to do so. But the scope of it is rather grand, and I think that from a standpoint of small offices, some of them are going to say, you know what, I just can't do this. Now, there are a couple of alternatives. One is you don't have any identified information in your office. Kind of hard to practice your profession without it. The other is not to do it at all. And I suppose some people, not many, but some will opt not to continue practice, feeling this is just too burdensome for them. And that would be a shame, but I think it was envisioned as a possibility.
Well, Paul, aren't some physicians deciding to have a paper-only practice and not transmit any electronic transmissions and get themselves out of a potential way of doing it? Mm-hmm. Just don't do any standard transactions.
Representative Proust.
We were exploring last session electronic prescriptions. Does this become a problem with this or not? I mean, it's point to point, certainly, but, I mean, do we have to have steeper or stronger firewalls and stuff like that in place there because of this? Or, I mean, has that been looked at yet? So,
the security rule implied that there were going to have to be significant firewalls. My understanding, and I may be wrong about this, my understanding is that the final security rule did not seem to have that onerous a requirement. For physicians interacting with people electronically, the verification of who you're sending things to is important. Coming up with a system to determine if, in fact, the person requesting it is authorized to receive it. Concepts of giving people passwords and the like. It's going to be interesting, but I'm not sure anyone thinks it's going to be impossible to transmit this information electronically.
Well, there's no unbreakable firewall. We know that. And there's nothing that can't be hacked into because everything so far has been. So, I guess I'm looking at this and I'm saying I'm damn proud that the government has done such an effective job of getting in the way of health care. And they truly have. But, it would be a shame because I think electronic prescription writing is the way we should be going for so very many reasons, and it would be a shame to think that something like this is going to get in the way of...
I don't think the rule is going to get in the way, Representative. Okay. The other thing I'd say is I think you should term this not the privacy rule, but either the reasonable privacy rule or the limited privacy rule, because I think both terms encompass the reality of what this rule can accomplish. And also, remember that one of the core concepts of this is it's scalable, they say. If you're a small office, you don't have to do everything that the world's largest office has to do. And my concern about that is if you're going to participate in security and privacy, then you ought to be participating to the fullest extent. But the rule does say that. So I'd say it's a limited rule, or at best, it's a reasonable standard rule.
I would call it the Federal Medical Paperwork Act, but that's just me.
Any questions?
Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is not a hypothetical question. Who all is covered under this act? And I'll give you a for example. Since the medically needy program has been discontinued, our office has been deluged with constituents in need of help in finding prescriptions. And we have now in our office detailed information on the prescriptions that a number of our constituents have, and we have connected them up with pharma patient assistance programs, etc. Are we covered under this?
Representative March, no, you're not. You would not be considered a health care provider despite the fact that you are facilitating access to another provider.
Thank you.
How much to become a health care provider while you're at it?
Well, I've been called Dr. March, but it doesn't. I don't expand it into the medical treatment area.
So, what about if you are a health care provider who have? I wasn't going to use any names based on the spirit of this legislation.
Okay, the doctor on this committee, then would that be better?
Well, he is covered.
That's a good question. I think.
I can tell you.
I don't think.
Well, I would.
In this kind.
Well, I think it's context. I think he happens to be a physician, but if he's not acting as a healthcare provider for the individual who's giving him the information, then I would say no. He could certainly decide to err on the side of caution and provide the kind of protections that HIPAA would require, but I don't think that would be required.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
No, I'll pass.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I anticipate your question. Here's one of those 101 really stupid questions.
There are no stupid questions.
There are no.
Representative Mona Sanderson has never asked a stupid question in my
That's
knowledge.
True. So maybe she should ask, it'll be a legitimate question. I mean, how real is this? I know it's law. I know everyone is bending over backwards, you know, because of the law. At the end of the day, 2 years, 4 years, down the road, how big a deal is this going to be? How many violations? I mean, is this going to be the, it comes from the patient who's disgruntled or the employee who's disgruntled. It's not going to be, you know, there's not going to be HIPAA police running around in nice little
there's
HIPAA.
There's no HIPAA long custody.
The,
That was clever.
You're buying dinner tonight. That's all I can say. How real is this? I mean, try to give me some scope or perspective of this.
I'll tell you what.
I can see where it impacts hospitals a heck of a lot more than physicians.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that there will be what you think of as whistleblowers, and we will see well-advertised raids like up in Hermiston and other places to make the point that we're watching you. But I think there's a far more important element to this, and that is it's now woven into the fabric of the healthcare delivery system, and in that there are lawyers who make their living unraveling that fabric by upholding the rights of individuals. And I see this as making its way into the litigation process as an element, a violation of the standard of care. And so I think that there will be private activity in this regard that will probably have much more impact. But I do think that if you ask me how real is this, it is very, very real in terms of what most people in any sized organization in healthcare are coping with. They are putting lots of money and lots of time into it. And I think as a result, they're going to lift the rest of us up and cause us to have to be aware. Yeah, I think it's going to be a real deal. It's going to take time. And I don't think you're going to see a policeman on every corner, but you're going to see enough over the next year and a half that the people that have had their heads in the sand over this are going to wake up and say, why didn't we do something about that? And that will be there. That's where we'll start getting more involved.
Mr. Chair.
I agree completely, and I do see, while HIPAA enforcement is, in fact, complaint-driven, I agree with Paul that it will be, there will be other opportunities for a review for HIPAA violation. The other thing I see happening is HIPAA being used in a litigation context because a patient who is thinking they want to sue will ask for an accounting of disclosures. They'll ask for access to their entire designated record set on their own behalf rather than having their attorney subpoena it and probably get more records by doing that. So I think it will be used in litigation context as well. I do think, though, that on the part of providers, it's been a huge effort. You cannot imagine the kind of work that I know Paul's association is doing, mine is doing, and all of our members are doing to come into compliance with this law. I hope, though, that after a few years, pick a time frame, that some of it will start to be routinized and will simply become part of the practice of the hospital, and the effort will not be quite as significant as it is right now as we come into compliance. I will also simply add briefly that I know that JCO, which is the accrediting entity for hospitals that choose to participate, is looking at HIPAA issues when they do their survey. They're not an enforcing agency. They don't have any authority to go back and report somebody, but they're looking at privacy issues when they survey. So I can see that sort of scenario, too. While it's complaint-driven, other entities that are surveying a hospital will be looking for these issues.
Representative Cruz. No, you lost your turn.
Well, I was just going to comment on the fact that we don't need HIPAA police. There's enough lawyers in the world to take care of that, I think. You know, but to drive that point, I mean, that's the potential huge downside of this is not only does it might drive some practitioners out of the game, but it's maybe going to put a dampening on collaborative relationships that are necessary for good health care, and you know, most things from the federal government are well intentioned. Many of them have huge downsides. I'm afraid this might be one.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cruz, I can tell you one of the things that Paul and I and others are working very hard to do, though, is avoid what we call HIPAA paralysis. Because we really don't want, come April 14th, to have providers and others refuse to disclose information that they could disclose under HIPAA for fear that they violated HIPAA. So much of our message is about what you can do as much as what you cannot do. Otherwise, we will end up...
Yeah, but Gwen, a few lawsuits change the whole dynamic, so...
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to get tort reform for HIPAA litigation. Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was talking to my dentist on another piece of legislation this morning, and they didn't really care about that piece of legislation. They were talking. They wanted to talk to me about HIPAA. And I said, well, that's not my bailiwick. but there is some
expert now.
Yeah, there is misunderstanding, because the first thing out of the receptionist's mouth was, we can't even have the sign-in sheet, but, you know, you just had that. So I can reassure that one, but how many others have now are going to be making these massive changes when they really don't need to? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morris Anderson, one of the things that people like Gwen and I do is when something like this comes up, we pretty much spend our life on the road talking to hospital organizations. Tomorrow I'll be in McMinnville talking to a group of physicians and their staff. It's one person at a time, and what we're trying to do, we got a head start. It's been 2 years and almost 3 months since we started pushing this thing, and we're just going to hit everybody. And that's how the professional organizations are ones that kind of take a leadership role, and I think the newspaper begins to take a leadership role as it becomes closer in time, and we'll get people educated. The most important thing that we were able to do, I think, is we brought all the players together for the HIPAA forum starting in June of 2000. And what's happened is, even though the privacy side of things has slowed down a bit on the forum, the insurers, every one of them, who you all know may not necessarily cooperate with each other on much of anything, sit down regularly as part of what's called the Transaction and Code Set Group, and they are writing the rules of the game in Oregon collaboratively daily to make sure that information will flow on form in formats and with data that is appropriate. That is the most, that even if we did nothing else in HIPAA, and even if we thought it was the worst thing in the world, that effort has been so important in terms of cost and in terms of quality that it's probably been worth it. And they'll work together on other things. So in a way, in a peculiar sort of way, this has brought us closer together. And we had the opportunity to stand at 100 yards and shoot at each other, but we chose to come together because we all knew it was going to sink us if we didn't. And so we collaborate, others collaborate, and in some funny way, I figure we'll get through it. The interesting part is that the dentists have participated, but not as much. And I think why they've stood off a little bit, I don't know. And I wish if you had any influence at all, you could influence them to get involved, because I think it would be very helpful for them.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Green.
Just a comment first and then a question. My comment again is I think many of these things at the doctor office level and at the hospital level are really good things that should have long since happened and shouldn't have taken a federal law to make them come into place. And consequently, the federal law is coming into place, and it's going to overstep. The pendulum is going to continue to swing, and we'll have to correct it, I'm sure. And this obviously has some real issues for researchers like me who use data, and for health insurance plans like our contractors who really, we talk about where the cost of money is coming. Our contractors are going to be spending money that's going to relate to dealing with these things in a very real way that's going to affect the viability of the health plan in a very specific way. But you mentioned yesterday that HIPAA is the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act or whatever. Are there other components of HIPAA that are affecting Oregon in addition to these data confidentiality? I mean, are the portability requirements, are there other things that are affecting the state for better or for worse as a result of that, what, now four-year-old act or something like that?
There were some rules, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, there were some specific changes with respect to the portability of insurance. That was probably its best moment in terms of what it accomplished. So if you go from state to state, It improves the ability to access insurance and to take your insurance policy with you when you go, et cetera. The administrative subset, the administrative simplification, that perhaps was not its finest day in terms of, so far, its finest day. But, yeah, there were some other good things, I think, primarily in the area of portability.
Well, but if I may follow, that the thing you just said that caused our insurers to begin to standardize forms and do a variety of things is under that, right. Isn't that under that subset that you just mentioned? And you just said that was worth the price of admission in its own
right. Right. Correct. However, the information was, billing was happening. Insurance billing was happening, and it was happening within the state of Oregon, maybe not at the same pace, but it certainly was happening. What this really reflects is the ability to transmit information across state lines if you're a multi-state plan. The real advantages came to the Aetnas and the, I can't remember some of the other big names. I'm unconvinced, this is just my personal opinion, I'm unconvinced that on a local level it would dramatically improve either cost or quality directly. But the fact that they've now gotten together to do that, that was at great cost. I mean, that the cost of that is yet to be accounted for and realized. So I'm a skeptic until I see what the cost-benefit of it was. It sounds great that they have these common data sets, but I've yet to see where that's going to lead us. And if it leads us there, I'm all for it. If it doesn't, I want to know how we account for that and how it's going to impact the availability of care when those dollars went to do this and didn't go to deliver the care. That's kind of how I see it.
I can say the hospitals are a little more optimistic on the transactions piece. Not that it's not costing a lot of money to comply, but they're a little more optimistic about its ultimate effect.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's been fun. Let's do it again.
Yeah.
You're now HIPAA heroes.
Next time we have a federal law, please come in and help us with this.
We'd like some diplomas or something.
I will send you
Bates.
A HIPAA hero certificate.
Bates wanted CME credit, but he didn't show up for the last session, so he loses his CME credit.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Thank you very much.
Seeing no other business come before the committee, we are adjourned.